your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the time of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein, and my guest today is journalist Sarah Kendzior. We asked you, our listeners, which expert you'd most like to hear on Russia and Trump, and you overwhelmingly picked Sarah. She's here today to talk about Vladimir Putin and his intricate strategy to influence the United States and other Western countries through propaganda, fake news, and cyber warfare. Sarah earned her PhD studying authoritarian states in Central Asia, so she's seen these Putin-esque autocracies up close. She studies how the internet affects political mobilization, self-expression, and trust, and she speaks Russian and Uzbek. Last week, President Trump bombed the Shayarat airbase in Syria, where Russia has troops on the ground supporting Syrian forces. So we've got two nuclear powers staring each other down in the Middle East as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson prepares to leave for his first official trip to Russia this week. There's no better time to deepen our understanding of Russia and its hardline authoritarian leader, Vladimir Putin. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Why is Vladimir Putin so preoccupied with influencing U.S. public opinion and U.S. elections?
I mean, he always has been ever since he, you know, came into power. I think that there's been shifts in both politics and in technology that have allowed him to be more effective in recent years, you know, but we've seen this kind of election interference, you know, in other countries besides the U.S. as well. This year, I think, you know, he was presented with two candidates, you know, one of whom was his direct antagonist in terms of Hillary Clinton, who would, of course, continue the sanctions and I think have a harsher stance towards him, and one who was very malleable and also possibly, you know, tied to Russia and influenced by Russia through financial deals and other arrangements that have been made in the past. So, you know, obviously he would be a preferable person for Putin to have in power.
Some intelligence analysts have said that Putin's initial goal was just to be a chaotic influence on the election, but that he eventually gravitated towards a preference for Trump. Does that make sense?
I mean, I think both things are possible. You know, in a sense, it's a win-win. I mean, to start off, I think that, you know, our institutions were already fragile before Russia intervened in any way. I think because they were fragile, you know, Russia was able to pull off, you know, what they seem to have done in the manner that they did it. So I think in one sense, they're exacerbating problems and crises that already existed in, you know, making them worse through propaganda and political maneuverings and other means. But I think he also, you know, preferred Trump to win in part because, you know, Clinton was a fiercer opponent in terms of Russia's geopolitical aims, but also because of this long history that Russia seems to have with Trump, you know, ranging from Manafort to Trump's connections to oligarchs, to various people who Trump employed in the cabinet, including, you know, Flynn, who's now gone, but also Jeff Sessions, Rex Tillerson, who received the Order of Friendship. You know, Trump designed a cabinet that's extremely pro-Putin, that has, you know, many individuals that have personal ties and corporate ties. And, you know, obviously that works to their advantage.
Can you talk a bit about Russia's track record interfering in the elections of other countries besides the United States prior to 2016?
Yeah, I mean, they've, you know, attempted to intervene in Georgia, in Baltic countries. You know, they are allegedly involved in the Brexit referendum. They're currently making a push in France. And, you know, they've had varying degrees of success in these measures. And, you know, at the same time, you know, there's been a growing shift toward right-wing politics that you see all over, you know, Eastern Europe in particular, in Poland and in Hungary, and, you know, Russian propagandists have exploited that, you know, much in the way that they exploited the vulnerabilities of the U.S., they exploited the vulnerabilities of these other states. So, you know, I think it's a combination setting out to do, you know, a deliberate kind of maneuver to, you know, either weaken their own former territory of the Soviet Union. I don't think Putin ever got over the collapse of the USSR as a superpower, and then also weakening Western adversaries, both to boost their power, but I think, again, as a kind of form of revenge, you know, to put people in their place, to lift Russia's status and to divert attention away from Russia's own domestic problems. You know, and one great way to do that, the classic whataboutism of Russia, is to highlight the difficulties that other countries are experiencing.
Why is Putin so interested in promoting Brexit and the collapse or the weakening of the European Union?
Well, the European Union is a great foe towards Russia in terms of certain things that Russia wants to do, for example, invading Ukraine and taking over Crimea. And so, you know, a weakened, disorganized EU is advantageous. An EU that has people in positions of power who, you know, just outright favor Putin, people like Farage or Le Pen, you know, is advantageous to them. We also have the issue of NATO, which several, you know, new right-wing Western leaders want to either do away with or weaken. We see Trump's own stance on it, where he says it's unnecessary or seems to treat it sort of like a, you know, a mafioso protection racket where they're supposed to pay up their sum in order to, you know, maintain the protection that they're supposed to get under international law. You know, which is a very unsophisticated view of how NATO works. And I honestly am not sure Trump understands how NATO works. But, you know, all of that works to their advantage, because if they want to continue this imperialistic expansion, you know, that they began with Ukraine, in which I think that they are considering in terms of, you know, ventures into the Baltics or into other countries that have a somewhat substantial Russian minority population. You know, that's the kind of rhetoric they use to justify it. A strong EU and a strong NATO would be detrimental to that aim. So, of course, they want to weaken it.
Michael Weiss had an interesting quote about Russia's style of propaganda, and he says, Russia combines Soviet-era whataboutism and Czechist active measures with a wised-up postmodern smirk that says everything is a sham. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think that that's, you know, accurate, and, you know, that kind of rhetoric's been going on for a while. I mean, they basically transposed tactics that they've been using for a very long time, tactics initially developed under the KGB in the Soviet Union, into a digital sphere. And it's a lot easier for them to do these sort of psychological or propaganda maneuvers in the internet, where you can be anonymous, where you can create, you know, armies of bots, where you can hire out people, you know, in order to do your bidding in other languages. You know, they have a very sophisticated propaganda apparatus. And, you know, I think they're attempting to do multiple things. They're attempting to have people, you know, lose faith in institutions that, you know, honestly, I think since the recessions and the wars, people were already losing faith in. And they want to sort of put into question the nature of truth itself. Does truth matter? Do facts matter? They'll present you with an alternate version of reality that maybe suits your emotional needs. And they're, you know, they're good at that. They're very studied at that.
Why is Russia interested in undermining the idea of truth? I mean, the traditional sort of propaganda thing the Soviet Union did was to say, well, you know, we have the truth. Other people are lying to us. You should believe us. And we have actually objectively achieved this workers' paradise. What is the new strategy there in saying, getting people to give up on the idea of truth as such?
You know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and with the sort of pseudo-democracy that came into play in Russia, you know, there was not kind of a great guiding, you know, ideology that filled that void. It was basically filled by nationalism and by a revival of Russian orthodoxy. But, you know, but most of all, what you saw was the emergence of a plutocracy, of a, you know, hyper-capitalist, oligarch-dominated society, you know, which when sort of spelled out to the average person, you know, like these are the people who run your world, these are the people who have power, and, you know, you're very unlikely to be in that position, is unattractive to the Russian population. And, you know, you saw that in the protests that were held recently, which were, you know, not specifically anti-Putin in nature, but they're anti-corruption. And so, you know, with corruption as something that's not a marketing point, they can't really lead people in a positive direction. And so they instead go into denigrating all of their rivals in order to make Russia seem superior to them. You know, sometimes this goes into ethnic or white supremacist kind of premises. You know, it's another thing that has been rising in Russia and that has, you know, led to a kind of multinational white supremacist alliance that you see in Europe and in, you know, the United States as well. You know, but when you have something like that, when you're making these kind of bigoted claims, when you're trying to cover up corruption, you don't want clarity and truth. So, you know, it's more advantageous to have things be as muddled and as kind of emotionally compelling as possible.
So what Russia is really trying to do is kind of put forward the message of, well, you know, everybody sucks, including people you might raise up as heroes. So, you know, we may be kleptocrats, but who cares? Everybody is. We should just stay home and watch TV.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I sometimes see this sort of rhetoric, you know, reiterated in American punditry. And, you know, my take on it is like, you know, yes, the U.S. is deeply flawed. Yes, we have our own version of plutocrats and of billionaires that wield way too much political influence. But ideally, the goal should be to change that, you know, to stand up against that, both in Russia and the U.S. And, you know, there should be some kind of, you know, consistency in condemning those sorts of practices, regardless who is the one who is practicing them. Whereas with Russia, the way they phrase it is sort of like, you know, well, we get a pass because you did it too. And that's how Trump sees it. You know, when he talks about how, you know, Russia gets away with this and that, it's not out of condemnation. It's out of envy. I think that because he's had to work within the confines of U.S. law, although he's been very skillful using loopholes to exploit those confines and, you know, get away with a lot of corrupt actions on his own, he's never been able to do it to the degree that Putin has, to the degree that prominent Russian oligarchs have. And I think that the sort of position that Putin is in is, you know, something that he desires and he would like to have himself.
David Remnick made a really interesting point about the weaponization of cynicism in Russia, that he observed that under the Soviet Union, there was so much hypocrisy that people lived with because there was the high-flying rhetoric of the state, and then there was the corrupt base reality that everybody lived with and denied. And his theory is that the new Russian propaganda strategy is kind of what came out of that. That kind of cynicism has now become a way of life and a political tool.
Yeah, I think that that's accurate. I also don't think it's unique to Russia. You know, like my specialty is in post-Soviet Central Asia, and that kind of cynicism is widespread. I think you find it in any country that has had, you know, corruption so ingrained in the system, countries where you're expected to pay bribes, where the idea of a meritocracy or of fairness or of justice is just a joke. You know, and we have elements of that, too, in the United States. You know, and I think, you know, there's a lot of things going on, but one of the problems with that is that when you have that much cynicism, and then when you have that much paranoia, because I think this sort of lack of belief in the idea of facts itself, you know, leads you to be more accepting of conspiracy theories. The opposite of that level of suspicion is unfortunately credulity. You know, people take in all sorts of information. They don't know how to parse it. They don't know how to figure out, you know, what is accurate, you know, what is meaningful, what is true. And that's for, you know, a number of reasons. You know, one is because they're getting a propaganda onslaught from numerous parties, but also because their leaders, you know, the ones who are supposed to be truthful, who are supposed to be serving them, are participating in that as well.
What is fake news in the Russian context, and how do they use it to shape global public opinion?
You know, it's somewhat similar to how it operates in all sorts of different, you know, international contexts. I think that every country at this point, because of the internet, has some element of quote-unquote fake news, you know, and to sort of break that term down, you know, when I think of fake news, I think of something with the deliberate intention to mislead, something more akin to propaganda, and often stuff just that's, you know, sloppy reporting or reporting with errors gets lumped into that category, you know, but I think it doesn't quite fit because the error is unintentional. But you know, in terms of fake news as propaganda for a longer time, I'm not sure how self-aware people are. You know, I honestly worry about younger people worldwide. You know, when I give talks at universities that go on this topic, I'm often asked here in America, like, how do I tell what a fact is? How do I tell, you know, truth from fiction? And, you know, these are educated young people. These are people trying to figure it out. And they're genuinely overwhelmed with the kind of, you know, social media and digital media onslaught of political content that they get. And so I think people in Russia are in a very similar situation. The key difference is that they do not have freedom of speech to the degree that we do. You know, they can be punished for a blog entry or for, you know, saying something that Putin finds insulting or even putting out pictures that he finds insulting. And so there's an element of self-censorship and fear there, you know, that's in place as well. And so if they're going to, for example, post a fake news story that praises Putin or says that something, some atrocity Russia committed, didn't really happen, you know, that might be for the reason of safety as well.
How do the bots play into this? What are they, and how does Russia use them?
That's something that I think needs more research and debate. You know, there have been some people that are researching them, and, you know, you heard this mentioned during the Senate hearings as well. You know, there are bots that are used, you know, basically troll farms, you know, not computerized ones, but people whose job it is to jump into conversations, supply lies, essentially, and try to misdirect people who are engaged in some sort of political debate in whatever direction the Russian government or whatever government wants them to go. You know, then from what I've read, there are other bots that are basically programmed by algorithms to look for certain keywords or phrases and to, you know, again, amplify certain points. And this has an effect, unfortunately, of duping actual real people who are engaged in these topics into believing that there's, you know, a mass movement around a point. Like when something is retweeted a lot of times, when it's liked a lot of times, it takes on this sort of veneer of credibility that it might not really merit. And I think that that's often the point of it. And also, I think targeted harassment is something that a lot of people experience online as a result of this campaign. And, you know, that's meant to suppress debate instead of to lead people to a certain conclusion.
Adrian Chen has done some fascinating research on the bots and the weaponized trolls. Are the bots basically the automated counterparts of the trolls, where Russia had first hired people or still does hire people to be doing these things, and then they've taken it to the next level of technology?
I mean, from what I understand, yes. But I think as a result of the investigation into Russian interference, people are really trying to get to the bottom of, you know, what exactly they did, who are they targeting, who fell for it, you know, where do they live, how are they funded? A lot of these questions are still up in the air. And, you know, Adrian Chen did one of the most in-depth reports on this, and he did it well before we realized that this is going to be, you know, a seminal factor in the election. But I would guess that, you know, more hard information on the subject is still to come.
And how does hacking work into this overall kind of weaponized information matrix?
It's important. I mean, we see the role of WikiLeaks in the election. I think that there's, you know, this sort of goes back to what I was saying about people losing faith in institutions in the U.S. I think that the release of hacked material through WikiLeaks exploited this idea that, you know, the government wasn't trustworthy, that political parties weren't trustworthy, and that WikiLeaks, because it had access to secret material, you know, was somehow the arbiter of truth. And this played on WikiLeaks' old reputation. You know, I think they've gone in a very bad direction since when they originally started out, when they were allegedly supposed to, you know, reveal the most corrupt and deplorable aspects, I didn't mean to use the word deplorable there, you know, of certain oppressive governments, and reveal them to the population in the hopes that that will cause reform. That doesn't seem to be their goal anymore. They basically seem to be operating as Putin's lackeys. So it's not just the hacks that are important, but who distributes them and how that, you know, organization or individual is perceived, you know, and the flip side of this, of course, is that this can be used as blackmail and threats. And, you know, from what I've read, the RNC was hacked as well, and it was used in this manner. I wish that there's more reporting on this, because I think that it explains a lot of actions of, you know, Republicans in the House and Senate, and, you know, why they're backing Trump, why they sometimes seem to, you know, start to investigate something and then abruptly stop. You know, this is a very typical process that, you know, authoritarian states use all over the world, and I don't know why we would be any more immune to it.
It's fascinating. As we speak, Trump has just bombed an airfield in Syria, which was the exact opposite of what he said he was going to do, and certainly the opposite of what somebody who wanted to get closer to Vladimir Putin would do. Do you think this is some kind of feint? Because it seems to be happening just as the heat is really turning up on the Russia investigation. Do you think Trump is hell-bent on proving that he's not Putin's puppet?
And I think ideally he'd like to prove he's not Putin's puppet, because he would like to, you know, have this entire investigation end, because it's affected his staff and him in very concrete ways. You know, we've had multiple recusals. We've had Flynn having to resign. We have all this inquiry into Trump's background and finances and relationships. But, you know, something like an airstrike in Syria isn't unilaterally made by Trump. I don't think that Trump has particular, you know, geopolitical expertise in Syria or in anywhere, to be honest. I have a feeling that this strike, you know, may have been designed by people like Mattis, who have their own goals and objectives, but also realize that, you know, yes, this can turn attention away from, you know, what Trump is doing. You know, one thing that's interesting is that they didn't bother to notify Congress before they carried out this military initiative, but they did notify Russia. And in some
degree, the deconfliction line. The deconfliction line is fascinating. I would love to have one of those.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, they notified them in part just to, you know, say, heads up, you know, you're here, we're about to do this strike. And, you know, that makes sense. But I feel like a lot of this kind of heated rhetoric that we're seeing today between different Russian officials, different U.S. officials, I'm a little bit skeptical that we're really at odds with Russia in the way it's presented. You know, you have to remember that Russia is also dealing with a domestic crisis. You know, they just had these mass protests against Putin's administration. Trump's dealing with a domestic crisis because his poll numbers are terrible. And, you know, as we know, Trump is the master of projection. And he, you know, in previous tweets years ago, talked about how the natural thing for Obama to do if his poll numbers are low is to bomb Syria or bomb another country. And, you know, well, here we go. So, you know, I think that that actually is his mentality. But Syria is very complicated. I don't think it's as simple as they just carried out a military strike purely as a diversion. I think that, you know, one, there was a chemical gas attack, mm-hmm. but there have been many before that we did absolutely nothing about. But, you know, that is a somewhat legitimate reason to do this. I feel better about the strike if it wasn't being carried out by the Trump administration, which has been both, you know, incompetent and sadistic. But, you know, there is some sort of more rational explanation for why they did it, too.
It seems to me that the left is having trouble coming to terms with the gravity of Russia and its interference, and it often seems like people feel guilty about having backed WikiLeaks, given the role that it may have ultimately had in electing Trump.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly seem to have trouble coming to terms with what's happened. You know, I find it very interesting that people who identify as being on the left, you would assume would be anti-imperialistic, anti-plutocracy, anti-corruption, are backing Putin or making excuses for him or, you know, sort of saying any kind of critique of, you know, what Putin does is somehow Russophobia or McCarthyism or red baiting. These are the exact terms that are being put out in Russian propaganda, and they get echoed in American pundits that have this bizarre sympathy. You know, they seem to think that the Soviet Union hasn't ended. You know, I don't know where red baiting would come from, because this is not a communist country. It, you know, it hasn't been for, you know, over 25 years. And so, yeah, I don't know whether they realize that, you know, their own rhetoric, their own kind of complicity in this is questionable. I do think that, you know, many, many people believed that Hillary had a lock on this. So maybe they felt a little more free to kind of make these baseless claims that Trump's a non-interventionist, Trump is dovish. I mean, there's nothing to back up those claims, because Trump said throughout the campaign that he intended to, you know, quote, bomb the shit out of people, that he intended to bring back torture, that, you know, he had an anti-Muslim agenda. Like, you know, none of this is new. And the strikes last night shouldn't have been surprising. But they seem to just not have very much interest in the fairness of our elections and our sovereignty, in the kind of authoritarian practices that both Russia and Trump are putting out. And I would just think, you know, if you have any kind of interest in justice or, you know, humanitarian quality of life, you know, if you have any interest in the suffering that people are experiencing under either of these regimes, that you would want this investigation pursued, but they don't seem to want that.
Do you think that there's any risk that we could be indulging in authoritarian tendencies within our own society and culture if we get too worked up about ferreting out ties to Russia?
I mean, I think we've always had authoritarian tendencies in American culture since America was founded, and even before. You know, we're a country that was founded on stolen land from Native Americans. We've had slavery, we've had internment camps, we've had Jim Crow. You know, we've always been a deeply flawed democracy that has managed to, you know, engage in brutal and unconstitutional practices quite well on our own. So I don't think that, you know, Russia would necessarily be the cause of this. The thing that's unnerving is that, you know, as decades has passed, we've moved away from this. You know, we've changed our laws. We've tried to make laws that are, you know, more fair and more just. And now we're moving in a direction that's backwards. And when Trump looks to Russia, you know, he doesn't see a human rights disaster. He doesn't see, you know, an authoritarian state that obviously the United States wouldn't want to emulate. He repeatedly says, you know, how strong Putin is, how great Putin is, and seems to admire him. And so I think that he would like to govern, you know, in a manner similar to Putin. I think that, you know, especially in terms of kleptocratic impulses, the kind of money that Putin and his lackeys have been able to accumulate through abusing executive power is extremely appealing to him. And so, you know, yeah, we will go backwards, both in terms of emulating Russia, but also just in terms of, you know, putting someone like Jeff Sessions in the attorney general's position. You know, that's an extension of anti-civil rights policies that, you know, obviously well predate the Russian interference scandal.
Is there any reason to be afraid of the implications of what we might find? I mean, if we take this investigation all the way to the end and it turns out that Russia clearly stole the election?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm more afraid that we will not find out what happens, because I think that, you know, there's value in truth. You need to know, you know, to whom is your government loyal? Is your government engaged in corrupt activity? You know, those are basic questions that we should be able to ask and get the answers to. And the fact that Trump and his administration seem to desperately want to stop this investigation is very unnerving, because if, you know, they were innocent in it, I don't think that they would be trying so hard. I think it will be very hard for society as a whole to deal with the ramifications of a president who may well have committed treason, who may well have, you know, people in his campaign or in his staff that committed treason, even if it's not full-fledged treason, you know, have engaged in activities that are, you know, essentially anti-constitutional, anti-American, that obviously don't put the needs of the American public. I don't think we've ever had a case quite like this. You know, we've had a lot of scandal. We've had a lot of corruption within our government. You know, Watergate is an obvious example. The, you know, WMD, fake pretext for the Iraq War, is another example. But we've never had to ask ourselves, you know, what country is our president most loyal to? Is it the United States? You know, that's kind of a mind-blowing thing, I think, for people to process. And if that's proven, you know, there's going to be both chaos, I think, in terms of, you know, well, if he is impeached or if he has to leave office, who will be next? Is that person implicated as well? But also, you know, how vulnerable are we? Like, how vulnerable are our institutions? You know, how do we move past this? And in terms of people who voted for Trump in good faith, you know, not knowing at all that he was involved in this, their feelings have to be considered as well, because I think that they may see this as some sort of contrived political maneuver just to get him out because people don't like him or they disagree with him, whereas it's actually a matter of national security and sovereignty. You know, and that's why I think it's very important that this investigation be bipartisan, that it be independent, and that it be as open and transparent as possible, because I think people need to see, you know, the process of getting to the bottom of this. They need to see, you know, how people are proving their point, and if Trump is guilty, how that guilt is proven, because I don't think anyone's going to just take someone's word for it at this point.
Do you think there's any danger, if we really nail this down, that it could push us closer to war with Russia?
Like, in terms of military conflict, you know, I don't think so, but I mean, the last few years, you know, if you had asked me like 3 or 4 years ago, would Donald Trump be the president of the United States, I think I would have answered no. So, you know, there are a lot of things that are hard to predict. I think that we're definitely going to see an escalation in this kind of cyber attacks and cyber espionage. You know, that's already going on. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, for example, Russia tries to hack things that, you know, are worse than even hacking our election system, like our power grids, so, you know, or trying to get, you know, access to our weaponry, things like that. You know, and that's its own kind of danger. I think that we're in a new kind of conception of warfare, like one that's much more technologically motivated, one that can be done from a distance without having some sort of like boots on the ground presence. I'd be very, very surprised if we got into a situation where we had troops in Russia or Russia had troops in the United States. I would be very surprised if it came to that.
It's really fascinating the way in which cyber warfare has become this equalizer where Russia, which is no longer a superpower, can in big ways affect the history of the United States without hardly spending any money or putting any of its people at physical risk.
Well, they extend a lot of money. I mean, they extend a lot of money into paying, you know, all these people who are doing the cyber warfare, who are creating the propaganda. You know, the budget for their propaganda outlets is immense. And so, you know, they are able to do that. And, you know, and they do, they are, you know, one of the world's major nuclear weapon powers. So.
That's true. But the cost of even one warhead or one fighter jet, you can hire a lot of bots and trolls for that. It's relatively cheap.
No, and I think that they also, they have, you know, like most countries since 2008, a struggling economy. You know, theirs is in a lot worse shape than ours. And I think that this is possibly an attractive job prospect for people who can't find other work. And so it's kind of a growth industry over there. But yeah, you know, I don't know whether to say, I mean, they're not a superpower, but I'm kind of wondering, like, who is a superpower nowadays? Because every country seems to be struggling. Every kind of, you know, union, something like the EU, seems much more fragile than it used to be. But it is true that they can redefine the terms of warfare. They can redefine, you know, ways of attacking people. They can basically do it from within by manipulating people within their own countries to carry out the kind of outcomes that they want. And that's smart. You know, that's cost effective. It's often very hard to prove. It's hard to detect. And it relies on that person to be somewhat complicit, you know, whether consciously or not, in the betrayal of their own country, you know, which of course leads to the kind of uncomfortable questions that you just brought up.
What can we all do to steel ourselves against the influence of propaganda, not just Russian propaganda, but propaganda in general, our government, corporations, anybody?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think that's something people are really wrestling with. You know, I mean, the way to steel yourself against it is through critical thinking, but this is very difficult because, you know, you and I work in news. We read a lot of news all the time. We're parsing information. We're trying to figure out what's true because it's our job and we have like a lot of time on our hands to go about doing that. For the average person who's just checking Facebook a couple times a day, turning on, you know, Fox News or something at night, you know, they're not going to go necessarily dig through everything for details, you know, not even out of lack of interest, just because they've got other stuff going on. So it's very easy to become susceptible to it. At the same time, you know, I feel like the solution to it is to dig deeper. Like if you see a story that looks suspicious or a website that looks unfamiliar, that's making some sort of bold claim, you know, fact check that claim, see if it appears elsewhere, see if you can get primary sources, you know, audio or video. Of course, those can be doctored as well, but it's, you know, a bit less likely. And I think just look for continuity, you know, find reporters and outlets that you trust. Ones that have sort of proven it for the long haul, ones that tend to see the events coming in advance, you know, that don't just follow the herd. I think that, you know, if you can find people that you trust, that's often an antidote for this sort of propaganda explosion.
Sarah, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now it's time for a feature we call Recommended Reading. Each week, I bring you some stories that shaped my thinking in my ongoing quest to come to grips with the current political crisis. The first is a piece by Elizabeth Drew in the New York Review of Books called No One to Blame But Trump. It's a masterful synopsis by a veteran Washington correspondent of the Trump administration 3 months on. It's Game of Thrones-level intrigue, its rocky relationship with Congress, all the Republican senators who quietly swear they're done with Trump, and more. Moving from the sublime to the ridiculous, we've got a little gem from last week's San Jose Mercury News called Trump's Border Wall Design Bids Due Today, and You Can Expect Some Doozies. Indeed, the designs have been creative, to say the least, including a nuclear waste moat within a border wall, a monorail wall, and a things-engraved wall where people would be able to pay to get their family trees etched on it. So the great big testament to whiteness would be paid for by a bunch of little testaments to whiteness. How meta. You can find these links at rewire.news/breach or in the show notes. That's it for recommended reading. The Breach is produced by Rewire. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Tweet your suggestions, comments, and questions to @Beierstein, Beyerstein, on Twitter. See you next week.